And as they headed into 65, that's when the folk rock thing started happening. Pop music, rock music started becoming conscious. And this is really the beginning of my favorite really era in Jan and Dean. It's like this whole 65 and 66 thing where they react kind of against the prevailing trend of rock becoming more and more and more serious and become more and more humorous. And yeah, I mean, it's fascinating when you look at him doing The Universal Coward. Let's talk a little bit about The Universal Coward, which is his second solo single. First one being Tomorrow's Teardrops, like way back in 62 or something, but or earlier than that, I guess. But let's talk a little bit about the strange like record that presents itself in one way, but is it something to be taken, on its on its, because basically saying that, oh, all the people protesting, Vietnam are just cowards who don't want to, and he presents that, but at the same time he also did a version which I juxtaposed today on the station of Eve of Destruction, where he sings the same lyrics,
Well,
as the
yeah, so
original.
it's like, yeah, the yin and the yang. You have Eve of Destruction, ultimate protest song, and then you have Jan's parody, Universal Coward. So, it's kind of funny. Dean called it counter satire, but so yeah, this is a divisive track. People, right wingers love it, left wingers hate it. That's a simplistic way to look at it today. But I think it's, regardless of Jan's political views, I think it's a parody.
Oh yeah.
And
And yeah, he was someone who was fairly desperately trying to get out of serving in Vietnam throughout this whole period, made sure he was enrolled
oh,
in
absolutely, yeah.
school, and yeah, he wasn't someone who wanted to go over to Vietnam himself by any stretch of the imagination.
No, but at the same time, his father worked for Howard Hughes, Hughes Aircraft, and they were a major contract for the military. So Jan was well versed in these geopolitical overview type
And
situations.
of course, California was a stalwart red state back then.
It's just, it's a goof, that song, Universal Coward. It's a goof on Buffy St. Marie's song, Universal Soldier. I mean, it's hilarious. And,
But that whole, a lot of that album, like, is, but at the same time, there's some really crystalline, almost quintessential LA folk rock. I mean, I can't wait to love you. I found a girl. It's got that same, sound as it's that LA Hollywood folk rock sound that Sonny and Cher had, the early Grassroots, the early Turtles. And I love hearing Jan and Dean in that musical bag. At times, that really heartfelt version of Where Were You When I Needed You, which is also done by the Grassroots later on, but also the Folk City, which is one of my favorites
Yeah, Folk
ever.
City is kind of brilliant because it's kind of this discordant, really tight vocal harmony strangeness that connects the folk rock scene to Surf City. But yeah, so it's just very strange.
It's a but an interesting way, I think, for Jan to attempt to adapt to what was happening. At the same time, he was recording more serious songs as well, like You Really Know How to Hurt a Guy, which is like his attempt at a Righteous Brothers Spectre type thing, big ballad, and doing a beginning from an end, which is kind of like a death rock song, which has an element of dark humor to it in some way in terms of its presentation. But I find this entire era of his music really fascinating, and it's interesting what happened when it turned to 66, when Jan got caught up in the whole fever over Batman.
Well, when you talk about Universal Coward and that whole progression to that stuff and beginning from an end, that's beginning from an end. When you think of Dead Man's Curve, right? It's we know that the driver of the Jag was killed, but it's implied. It's not specifically stated. With a beginning from an end, it's a little too overt. It's a little too, and so it doesn't quite make it, I don't think. But at the same time, if you know something about Jan, it's very telling because not only is he a second year medical student, but that's a fate, the death of a child, or the death of a mother rather, in childbirth. That's something that actually happened to Jan's family, to his father's first wife. And so it becomes a little bit more interesting, and you couple that, that specific track was one of the best musical tracks he produced that in that era without the vocals. So all kinds of interesting stuff happening. All the vocal covers on Folk and Roll are cool. They're really good. I just think that I think the political stuff with Universal Coward is in this era kind of overshadows everything.
Yeah, definitely. And let's backtrack a little bit and talk about the vocalists that Jan used on as backing vocalists on the sessions, and who those people were
for Folk and Roll.
No, for the for this entire era, really, when it was starting with, you know, Tony Minichiello and, you know, Matador's people, and Sloan and Barry, and the people he was using, you know, to get that vocal, that layered vocal harmony sound throughout the whole hit era of Jan and Dean.
Oh yeah, so that started with the Matadors, Tony Minichiello, Vic Diaz, and Manuel Sanchez. They were high school classmates of Jan's, and you know, not only he brought them aboard, but they were a hot combo in their own right. Mm-hmm. You know, they had their own record deal with Coalpix, which is also a Screen Gems artist. So it was all under the Screen Gems umbrella. And so Jan had this carte blanche to arrange music for his own act, which was his main gig. But they also, by you know, his contract specified you work with these other artists. Mm-hmm. And so he was able to, you know, work with, you know, not only fellow Screen Gems artists, but fellow high school classmates. So it was nice, and they were really good vocalists, the Matadors. Mm-hmm. And so they really informed Jan's records from the Surf City album and Drag City album, as Curb album, 1964. Mm-hmm. But at that time, with Jan and Dean transitioning from Nevin Scherzner up to Screen Gems, mm-hmm. you have the Matadors going off on their own to do their own thing. And so Jan needs help, right? He needs more vocal help. So through Lou Adler, he gets two new Screen Gems people that come online, and those are Steve Barry and Phil Sloan. And they're gonna, you know, those guys are signed to Screen Gems, and they're very young. Sloan's still a teenager, right, when he starts singing with Jan. And so Jan becomes a mentor to them, and they continue to rise. Lou Adler is a mentor to them, and really good vocalists and really good songwriters, especially Phil Sloan, right? Phil Sloan's eventually going to become, within three years of becoming P.S. Sloan, a singer-songwriter, right?
Yeah.
Very, very significant. And so it's an interesting dynamic between Phil and Jan, because there's an age difference. So there's mutual respect, but there's not a social connect, right? Because Jan is older and Phil is younger. They're not moving in so much in the same social circles outside of work, but they're dialed in at work. And I think Phil Sloan was a very important cog in Jan Barry's professional career and development.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, just a fascinating collection of people that are you find out about in this book. And so, you know, that it's
we're talking about Phil, and you mentioned the grassroots and all that later. Well, at the same time that Jan's working on Folk and Roll, and he's doing Eva's Destruction, the hit version of Eva's Destruction comes out, and that's, you know, Barry McGuire, and that Barry's track is the same track that Jan used for his, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And the grassroots version is after Jan and Dean's version of Where Were You When I Needed You. That came first. And when Jan and Dean did I Found a Girl, which is my favorite 1965 production by Jan Barry.
Great one.
Yeah. And so that's a Phil Sloan composition. Yeah. And Phil loved Jan's arrangement of it. And when you listen to that, like I noticed today, just before our interview here, you played I Found a Girl, the instrumental track, and when you hear the lead licks, the 12-string guitar lead licks, those are all played by Phil Sloan.
Oh, wow.
And so Phil was very close associates, and, you know, that's when Jan did Phil's arrangement there, Phil loved Jan Barry's arrangement of I Found a Girl. So that's the hit version, but then a little later we get Phil Sloan's solo version of I Found a Girl, and it's like completely different, right? It's like almost unrecognizable. It's this acoustic slow version, right? But Jan's came first.
Wow. And other guitar players, of course, that Jan worked with in the studio closely were the great Glenn Campbell, another guy who had nothing but nice things to say about Jan.
That's right.
As a record maker and as a person. And of course, Tommy Tedesco and Billy Strange, you know, used all these guys for very specific things in the studio.
Yeah, those guys, you know, as you said, Glenn loved Jan, but Glenn, you know, did read music like the others did, but he also had some of the best parts, like the guitar, the chord solo and popsicle. It sounds kind of like a banjo. It's really just Glenn Campbell on a guitar, you know?
Yeah, darn, darn, yeah, dude, that's incredible. That's an amazing solo. Then let's talk about the development of humor into the 1966. You know, we're kind of tracking that, talking about the humor of their doo-wop music, and of course, you know, and their surf and drag stuff, and the folk rock thing. But how they just, for some reason, they turned to that in '66 with the impetus of capitalizing on the Batman thing, which Jan in particular actually loved. You know, the TV series. You know, there's an element of parody, but there's a real element of tribute as well.
Right, and interestingly enough, there's a connection. You know, why did they pivot to that so quickly? Well, we don't. I mean, we can speculate. There's a connection. When Jan and Dean were doing their pilot, their TV pilot, late '65, early '66, who was the parent company of that? 20th Century Fox. Who was the parent company of Batman? 20th Century Fox. So Jan and Dean had advanced knowledge of the Batman television series. And so they were able to come up with a song kind of just as the, you know, the series was debuting, right? So, you know, Jan was into that stuff. Dean told me that Jan was more interested in the Batman concept than Dean was.
That's interesting.
But and so they just they took it from there, and you know, as a song title, you can't copyright Batman as a song title, but national periodical publications could copyright the Batman concept, right, for the comics. And so they ran into legal trouble with using Batman and Robin for stuff because they wanted to do comedic skits, not just song titles and song lyrics. And so the comedic skits are copyrighted differently. They're copyrighted as dramatic works and not as songs. And so they ran into trouble there. They couldn't do their skits as Batman and Robin, even though they actually did them, and recordings of them are still exist in that guise, but they couldn't release them commercially, so they had to retool it. And so,
yeah, well, thank God, because it's way better
right.
the
I mean,
redone version.
yeah. So the Batman and Robin stuff is there, but the project gets its real genius from, like you said, from them being able to be themselves and make themselves Batman instead of trying to portray Batman. They become Captain Jan and Dean the Boy Wonder, right? And so, you know, you know, they get their own in jokes and humor in. They mention the Beach Boys. They, you know, it just becomes a better comedic avenue.
Yeah, it becomes a satire of their own scene.
Exactly.
Yeah, again, the same way that the Who's Sell Out was for the Who, and Zappa's records are for Zappa. It helps to have some inner knowledge of it, but the whole thing is just hilarious. Those guys had just such a great comedic chemistry and played off each other so well.
Right.
And that's just a great, that and the following project, which was the unreleased at the time, Filet of Soul thing, really just shows them interacting at their best. Yeah, a little while back we were both on the same message board, and you were getting together things. I'd said something about, it went off on this soliloquy about Jan Dean meet Batman that you've quoted actually in this book, and thank you so much for the mention and quoting me and putting the name of Shades of Cool in there as well. I really appreciate that.
Well, yeah, because that kind of encapsulates the whole thing, right? I
Oh,
mean,
yeah.
that's
Well,
just
I'm glad you think. Yeah, well, thank you. You know, I appreciate it, because that's something I've loved for ever since I first got into it. I really got deeply into Jan and Dean's records besides the hits, because it's hard to find their records for a long time when the One Way CDs came out, and I just devoured all of those twofer CDs. And that one was a particular, became obsessed with it the same way that I had been obsessed with, you know, Rolling in It for the Money and the Who Sell Out. I just love projects like that, and that happened first before any of that, and had to have been influential.
Yeah, and you know, it's fun to get other, you know, like music journalists' takes on that, like Dave Marsh talking about, you know, it being descended from Stan Freberg and Dickie Gibbon, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Stan, you know, Lily Tomlin, the Firesign Theater. You can see it, right? It's all kind of, you know, kind of in the same vein.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And to me, like the presence of stuff like this in Janet Dean's career just makes me love it more and more.
And then Dave Marsh started drawing all these lines between Janet Dean and Frank Zappa and Alice Cooper and the Stooges. You know, it's just, it makes all kinds of sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then the Filet of Soul project, which took it to like an almost avant-garde. I wouldn't even say almost, like definitely avant-garde. I mean, that would have been their Lumpy Gravy.
And I would say avant-garde to the point of being taking it too far for the time, right?
Yeah.
Commercially, because I can see Liberty's stance on that, not releasing the original concept. Mm-hmm. I think they're just a little too ahead of their time on that one.
Yeah. But of course, originally, this concept, which was, you know, barely related to music, it had some music and some tunes on it, but was just foregrounding only the anarchic humor and just sound loops layered over it. Was cut into half and released as side four of the anthology album from 1971. And I fell in love with that as soon as I first heard it.
It was like a sound collage. But in, what's funny about that is when Dean Torrance did that, when he plopped that on side four of the anthology, there's no concept for it, right? There's no context for it.
Yeah.
So you're listening to all the hits on the album, then you flip it over. And then you start getting Filet of Soul, but we don't know it's Filet of Soul, right?
Yeah.
And so we're going, what the hell is this? We're going, what? So that was strange. And so we don't start getting the context for it until Dean starts letting stuff slide in later interviews, right?
Yeah.
And so we finally build the picture, and we see that stuff was from late 65, and Liberty wanted the what happened was Jan and Dean headlined the grand opening of the Hullabaloo nightclub there in Hollywood, which was this big, important venue. It used to be the Moulin Rouge, and before that, the Earl Carroll Theater with these two revolving stages. And
wasn't it also where the big TNT show was filmed?
Yeah, and when it came over to the Hullabaloo, it was kind of an attempt to counter the go-go clubs on the on Sunset Boulevard, and so they made it a teen nightclub, right? You had to dress up. The kids had to dress up in tops and coats. Girls had to wear dresses. You couldn't come in with pants. So Jan and Dean headlined the grand opening as part of a multi-artist lineup, right? And so Jan and Dean did these two concerts, and they were recorded, right? And they were going to release those in an album, as an album. Yeah. And so Jan and Dean wanted to, well, let's take this. We've already done a live album. Well, how can we really mess this and make it strange? And so they did that, and Liberty had a problem with it, right?
Yeah.
And so that's how.
The rejection of that project by Liberty was one of the things that was weighing on Jan's mind. Another one of the things, precipitating things, as just before Jan got into his accident. Now, I guess that's we should talk a little bit about the accident in terms of how the misinformation that has been passed down. You mentioned the whole thing about there being people in Jan's car, but I certainly didn't know until I read your accounting of it how it happened. I didn't know. I mean, I always pictured it being from the film, like he's speeding down the freeway or something. But no, he just hit a parked truck. Hit the side of his wheel hit the side of the curb, and then he just looked back at the wrong time, and that's it.
Yep, it was in a residential area in Beverly Hills, right in the heart of posh Beverly, Beverly Hills. And it's a Whittier Drive at that point. It's longer, but at this part that we're talking about, it's between Sunset Boulevard and Wilshire Boulevard, right? Residential area. And I've been there. I've been to this accident site, and it's these big, beautiful homes. And you would think you're driving 35 miles an hour down the street. That's what you should be doing. But obviously, Jan was not. He's a reckless driver, and he was gunning it. And it's not a freeway, just a residential area. But there was a gardener working in front of the house where the accident happened, and he had a 1964 Ford pickup truck, and he was working in the yard, and he witnessed the accident point blank. And he gave me a wonderful account of it. One of the accounts that fills in a lot of holes in addition to the police report and other documentation we have. But so, yeah, it appears that Jam speeding, probably gunned the accelerator for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. The back end swung out and hit his right wheel hit the curb. And when he did that, it apparently surprised him because he looked back over his right shoulder and mm-hmm. the gardener saw this. His name was Mitsuru Ando. And he described it and he said he looked back over his shoulder and by the time he looked in front of him again, it was too late. And he smacked the end of the gardener's truck. Right.
And an incredible coincidence, this guy ended up being someone who actually was a classmate of Jan's, right?
That's right. They were both in the 1958 Vagabond class at University High School.
Which is amazing.
And when Ando gave me the account, he told me that he knew it was an entertainer that had been injured because of stuff they pulled out of Jan's car. Mm-hmm. But he didn't learn it was Jan until a year later after the accident.
Wow, that's incredible. And you also do a really interesting thing where you talk about kind of an interesting, kind of eerie string of events that happened around that geographical location or in close proximity to it.
Today they call it the Beverly Hills Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
It's kind of a funny name, but I mean, yeah, there's some tours of weird Hollywood, stuff like that, macabre, you know, true crime. People are interested in that stuff. So that very narrow area there, you have stuff that happened, but it's made doubly interesting because two of those incidents are tied to Jan, not just the accident. The first one was Jan's father worked for Howard Hughes, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the crash thing, yeah.
Yeah, and so Howard Hughes was flying an experimental aircraft that crashed, right, in Beverly Hills in the 40s. He was trying to, he had problems, and he was trying to land at the golf course there at the country club, which is right adjacent to Whittier Drive there. And so he came down and crashed, right, and the crash nearly killed him.
Yeah, it was dramatized in the Scorsese film The Aviator about...
Exactly, yeah. What's his name? DiCaprio played that part.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's one thing. And then another one is the mobster was killed. Bugsy Siegel, right? He was murdered. He was shot. This is just, you know, a few hundred yards diagonally on the next street. Shot through a window from the outside, through the head. And they never solved the murder, right? And Bugsy Siegel is like a pretty famous mobster. So that's very, very close proximity. And then Ronnie Chasen, the film promoter, was shot near the intersection of Sunset Boulevard. And then she turned left on the Whittier and died and crashed the car just a few hundred yards from where Janet crashed his car.
And that's a mysterious one because no one knows, like, what. Like,
never solved. Yeah.
It's like an unsolved murder. Strange. Yeah, inexplicable one.
Right. And so what you have there is you have these tours of weird Hollywood now. They did mention this, and they mentioned Jan in it. But what I've done is give you a map to show you exactly where everything is. Mm-hmm. And so it ties into that whole thing of Dead Man's Curve and where it is and where Jan's crashed. That's all. That's another whole issue of the fiction or the mythology of where Jan crashed. Mm-hmm. And the book gives the exact location where it happened.
Yeah, and... in several points in the book, too, you have diagrams that you put together and drawn of key locations in Jan's life. And I think that's really evinces a real level of love for detail and atmosphere, because they do help. For me, when I look at that, I look at that diagram, I'm like, and then I'm reading, I'm like, oh, I'm there. It really helps with the visualization.
Maps are one of my things, and so when Dean described for me the layout of the garage studio, I said I'm making a map of that,
and the map of Jan's longtime house is amazing.
Yeah, Alita Berry and Brian Berry helped me map out the house.
Yeah,
and the photo Alita gave me, you can see the garage studio from the outside. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those visuals help a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about what happened. In the year or two after Jan's accident. I mean, in a certain way, there's a lot of different ways. I mean, it's really a glass half empty, glass half full on different occasions. Thinking about Jan's, for all intents and purposes, the Jan Berry that went into the crash never came out.
That's right.
You know, intents and purposes, you kind of have to look at what he did after that as kind of all being a triumph in comparison, considering how much damage he suffered.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, as a result of that. And it has to be inspiring for people who have gone through similar events, similar traumatic brain injuries. And it's amazing that he was able to do what he was able to do in terms of getting back into music Of course, it's you go into it in your book, and naturally, because you're telling the truth, it is very sad.
Oh, it's very sad, yeah.
But at times equally triumphant. I mean, particularly when you see them when they tour with the Beach Boys, and like what a highlight it is, when they come out. And I have several recordings, and the audience goes crazy when Jan and Dean come out. Like, it's a big deal. Dead Man's Curve was a big deal,
It was.
and Jan and Dean were definitely heroes, and particularly in Southern California. I remember, just growing up and them just being, legends. When I was a kid, I related way more to them than I did to the Beach Boys, just because they seemed related to stuff I was into that was contemporary, like punk rock, and you know what I mean? Like, there's just
Yeah, absolutely.
something really relatable about Jan Dean, particularly if you come from Southern California, as hometown guys. But let's talk about the period immediately after that, and Jan's life right after the accident, or the next 2 years after it, and how he got back into making music, and how Dean was trying to keep it going on his own.
Very crucial era, a very painful era. For Jan. So, obviously with Jan, he's out of commission, but again, bucking the mythology that you've heard all your life, and I say to you, that's like figurative. 1 year to the month after the car accident, Jan Barry returned to the studio to record music. So you hear all kinds of stories about him being in a coma for 3 months, and not, yeah, didn't happen. He started talking for the first time in May 1965, or excuse me, 1966, which is a month after the car accident. Right. So there's a progression there. And the damage he received to his brain was significant. Aphasia, partial paralysis, very bad prognosis. They thought was hopeful, but they couldn't say, it was early days. But he got back into it, had a lot of help. His father became his conservator, right? It was pushing the whole thing, Bill Berry. Very fascinating person, by the way. Bill Berry, I could write a book about Bill Berry just because of his career.
And also the
Very
rest of his family too. All your pictures of all of the rest of his family are amazing, including the mother and his brothers. Of course, one of them being Bruce Berry, who is a figure in the Neil Young story. He's the guy that one of the two guys that inspired the Tonight's the Night album. But the song Tonight's the Night talks specifically about him, Bruce,
That's right.
about him and his story. So the picture of his family, including Jan's son, which is also a very sad story.
Very.
That's really, really excellent. I really feel like I got to know them as I read that. And his father is certainly very fascinating. I mean, can you imagine the frustration and the heartache he underwent on behalf of his son?
Oh, it's palpable. I mean, and it comes across. You read his correspondence and you feel for him, You feel for Jan and try to be empathetic and put yourself in each person's place. And it's devastating, So with Bill Berry trying to, not only trying, but pulling off, paving the way for Jan to get back into the music business, it started with Alvin Bennett, give him a chance to go back in the studio and record. And then from there, you have the Warner Brothers picking up, buying those masters that Jan did for Hawaii, Fan 10, 11, Hate, bringing those into a Warner Brothers project. So, you have that. But at the same time, as that progresses, you have Dean trying to keep the Jan and Dean name alive and trying to take the bull by the horns and make things happen. And then he just is on the right track creatively, but he's on the wrong track legally because.
It knows
Because
no hope.
he doesn't have the legal authority to do it, and that's because when Jan crashed, their mother company, so to speak, Screen Gems, didn't cut them loose. They kept them, re-signed them, and so Screen Gems was governing everything, and so they killed all of Dean's efforts.
There was no way the Jan's family or Screen Gems. So he had two like major impossible to pass, impassable stones in his pathway. But I do really
That's right.
admire that work, and that was one of the earliest Jan Dean and Dean things I really got into, was the Save for a Rainy Day, Sunday's archival thing. And then through that got into Carnival of Sound, which was Dean's project, I mean Jan's project, that unfortunately got it was put together but then rejected as well, ironically, by Warner Brothers, not released. But they did put out a few singles.
Right, and Save for a Rainy Day, like I said, Dean was on the right track, and that stuff, really some good stuff on there. Some of those tracks are better than others, But that stuff's worthy of the Jan and Dean name, you know? Mm-hmm. It's complicated. It fell apart because of disconnects between Dean and Screen Gems. It's too much to go into. But with Jan coming along, that's also an interesting thing because he was not the same person anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. But he had collaborators. He had always worked with collaborators, so he was used to that. Things were coming along, but unfortunately, Jan suffered from an impulse disorder, a severe impulse disorder. And so what that meant was he didn't have the command that he had, the high intellect and the command of the situation that he had before the accident. So things would be going along at a good clip, and then Jan would blow everything up without meaning to. You know, he would just, you know, he would call studio executives and just not concentrate on creative stuff like he should have. And so they were creating these new songs. Joe Gibson was back helping him. Don Allfeld was helping him. Eventually, Roger Christian would come in to work on the stuff that would eventually be slated for Carnival of Sound. Mm-hmm. So
Glenn Campbell did some vocals. His work is still working with Dustin and Hal, right. Of course.
Hal Blaine, all the Wrecking Crew guys, and some new Wrecking Crew guys, and Tom Baylor, John Baylor, Ron Hicklin, those guys, Bogley, everybody that was this incredible team there to help them. They did. And they made some nice recordings, but ultimately they couldn't overcome Jan's impulse disorder because he just kept blowing up the situation without meaning to. And so it's very frustrating for him, for his creative team, and for us on the outside looking in. It's very frustrating, the whole thing is.
Yeah, definitely. But of course, the Carnival of Light recordings were put together and as a great gift to Jan Barry fans, but 50 years later. After Jan's passing. And what was it like working on that project?
That was nice. I was in New York in 2009. I was in New York to be on Dave Marsh's Kick Out the Jams radio show.
Right on.
And just happened that my friend Dominic Priori was in Brooklyn at the same time. So we were in New York at the same time. And he called me up and he said, let's meet and talk about this thing I'm working on. So we met in Central Park, and that was when Sundays was, that Rhino was working on putting the Carnival Sound out. So we talked about that. We agreed to work on the notes together. And then Andrew Sandoval was putting that whole thing together. So eventually I began collaborating with Andrew. Mm-hmm. We put together the chronology of the thing, and it was nice. I mean, it was just a nice...
Well, that's a great think tank to have, you know, people working on a project like that, you and Dominic and Andrew. Oh, really, it's a labor of love for each one of you guys, I know.
Yeah, it was nice. And just going back and forth with Andrew, my studio research, the stuff he had from tape boxes, just really good stuff.
It's great to have that piece to put in the Jan and Dean discography, just like it was when Smile was officially released. And Filet of Soul now as well, you know, to have that in its original form, having a separate release.
And just to hear the stereo remixes that they did, that Sandoval did, and that stuff, it was a revelation, because prior to that, bootlegs, you had, you know, some fairly good quality and some really poor quality. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, it might have 20 different versions of a bootleg. But that you had never heard the stuff as it was actually recorded before. And so that's the revelation of the Carnival of Sound release in 2010.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the aftermath of that, really continues with his with his therapy, and you know, gets involved in the LA drug scene, and gets into a bunch more car crashes. I think that's like one of the most like bizarre chapters of the Jan Barry thing, that he continued to drive and continued to get in car accidents, because you just think, like, after someone gets in a car accident that radical, that you would just think, oh well, of course they wouldn't drive again or be a, but no, Jan still drove, and unfortunately, with impulse control and all of that other stuff, there were some issues.
Oh, some major issues. Yeah, that was an eye opener, right?
Oh, so extremely.
You know, right when he's getting back in the studio, what's that, a year after the car accident, he's driving, right? He passes the driving test, right? He gets his insurance, and he goes out, and boom, he's crashing everywhere.
Yep. And also the story that you told that I didn't know about, that was super sad, about him getting assaulted, mugged.
Oh, that happened in 1985, yeah.
Yeah, that's a super sad thing as well. So he had some harsh things happen to him, even after. But his 70s career, which he released just basically a string of singles for Lou Adler, and I guess Lou Adler is a point of loyalty, released Jan Barry singles, you know, with no promotion, very low count of pressings, but did release Jan Barry singles throughout the 70s, which is cool. And I'm going to be playing some of those later on, like Mother Earth and Sing Sang a Song. And what do you think of that era of Jan's work?
Yeah, that was an important era. Yeah, Don L. Phil had tried to get Jan and Dean to sign with Gulf Pacific Industries in 69 to kind of pick up where Screen Gems left off. And when that fell through, that would have been the last Jan and Dean thing. When that fell through, that paved the way for Jan's solo career. And so he was writing songs with his friend Joan Jacobs. They did Mother Earth and they did some other stuff. And Roger Christian, being Jan's loyal friend from the early period through Carnival Sound through now in the early 70s.
And of course, he worked with Brian Wilson on Don't You Just Know It as well. Brian was there to help him as well in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. They did a promo single for Don't You Just Know It. And so Jan, importantly, in 72, his first lead vocal after the accident was Mother Earth, right? Mm-hmm. So he starts, you know, with Carnival of Sound, in the late 60s, he had been arranging and producing and writing songs and working with collaborators and others singing his material. And so by the early 70s, he starts singing again with Mother Earth, and then it just progresses from there. Lou Adler is facilitating his recordings. He's recording at A&M Studios. And then from he's on the Ode label, and then from there he progresses to the A&M label. Mm-hmm. So between like 72 and 78, that's kind of the peak era of Jan creatively in the post-accident era, mm-hmm. Both vocally and songwriting, arrangement, and production-wise.
And his relationship with Dean is very, very on and off during this period. And fitfully collaborated, you know, one time disastrously with doing a lip syncing skit. It was totally misunderstood on stage. And Jan's first real appearance with Dean again after the accident. But then, you know, at the Palomino Club right around the corner from where I grew up in North Hollywood in Lancashire, that happened. And then, you know, eventually towards the end of the decade, after the Dead Man's Curve resurgence of interest. They did start performing together with a couple different bands, including Papa Do Run Run, who were the band in Dead Man's Curve.
So they had performed separately. Jan was with a group called Down and Trip and Midler in 76 and 77. Dean was with Papa Do Run Run. And then in 76, Jan and Dean came together for the first time after the accident at the Palomino. They did a show, it was a Papa show with Dean, and they called Jan up and he sang, and it made national headlines like in Variety and stuff like that. And then it just progressed from there. The film came out in 78, and there was a huge groundswell of interest coming out of that. And Jan wanted to go back out on the road, and Dean didn't, so Jan did. Jan went out by himself with his own band called Aloha in 1978, and they toured the country.
Yeah, there's some interesting tales in the book about...
A lot, yeah.
It's very, very fascinating about what can, you know, what can go wrong, particularly when you have promoters who are unscrupulous and it's just basically we're always promoted in some ways being Jan and Dean, and even though like Dean was,
getting their wires crossed on the promotion, and Jan taking advantage of the interest, and Dean resisting it. Dean didn't want to play small clubs with Jan, right? And so it just, Jan and Dean got a gig in New York. They actually convinced Dean to join that, and it was their first big show out of California after the accident. Mm-hmm. They're in New York City at the Palladium, and you know, it just grew from there. They got on a tour with the Beach Boys. Beach Boys brought them on to help get Jan some publicity, and then in 79 they started touring with Papa Do Run Run. Dean had resisted until then. They signed with Great Eagle Entertainment, and then they just, Jan basically caved and joined Dean's operation.
And that went on for a bit before before it, you know, again, you know, on and off throughout the 80s, Jan and Dean's relationship, and including Jan's creativity as well. He did do some interesting work. I think the last song I'm playing tonight is one of those, Ocean Park Angel. It's kind of like a lost, you know, kind of another what if, because it's yet another one of the, you know, tragic legal things. You know, even that track, like they couldn't reissue or issue it properly because of the songwriting credit, and just like so many things like that, so many intrusions of business upon creativity in the history of Jan Barry.
Yeah, Alan Miles wanted too much money for the song. Yeah, that's all documented by Bill Berry. Yeah, very unfortunate. You know, whether it was a hit or not, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. That could have been, or should have been, I guess, their signature song of the 80s, but, you know.
And then in the 90s, Jan was able to finish His only solo album, yeah.
Yeah.
Except called
Second
Second
Wave.
Wave.
Yeah, and he started working on that in the late 80s. He had a young collaborator named Rob Kirkpatrick, and they worked on stuff long distance and together in L.A., and they finished it. They worked in a lot of different studios there in L.A. And some people who had worked with Jan originally are on the project, like Don Peake, one of Jan's best friends from the Wrecking Crew. So, yeah, some of the old and the new, and eventually went with One Way Records on that, which was a company that had released Jan and Dean's, had recently released their back catalog as two first, but they didn't issue singles, so there was no single from that, but they did release the album, 97.
Yep, and Jan, you know, toured, you know, on and off, sometimes with Dean, sometimes not, until, you know, the mid-00s, and his health started to fail him, and took a final turn, and fortunately passed away at the age of 52, was it?
62.
62, sorry, yeah, definitely. I don't know what I was thinking. 62. And it's so he did live another 50-some percent of his life after the accident.
Yeah, 38 years after the accident.
38 years, yeah, exactly. And
yep.
He was 24 when it happened?
25.
25, yeah.
The accident happened just after his 25th birthday. Yeah. He turned 25 on the 3rd of April, crashed on the 12th.
Yeah. So, I mean, so it is definitely... you know, a triumph that he survived as long as he did, considering what a rough time he had of it.
Very much a triumph. And in terms of his therapy, which is a big part of his story, his therapist always thought he could have done better, right, in recovering. They thought he could have made a lot better progress, but he was so intent on returning to music because he could sing better, he can talk, and was so focused on that, he developed his own coping mechanisms, which were not ideal from a therapist's perspective. So they would try to get him to do different things to, you know, learn how to speak better, learn how to write better, and he would always kind of meet them halfway, but always kind of stop, be stubborn, and say, no, this is how I'm doing things. And so he was able to get back out on stage, have a new career with Dean, that whole thing, but it was always a partial recovery, and it was never as far as his therapist thought he could have gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. When did you meet Jan?
Well, I spoke to him on the phone mostly. Mm-hmm. I had seen him in concert in 1981, but I started speaking with him by phone in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. And what are your memories of talking to Jan? Your dealings with him personally?
Well, I was trying to get this project off the ground before I spoke with him, and he was not interested in this at all in the beginning because he had heard all this before. Oh, somebody wants to write a book. No, I've heard this before. I've been ripped off. No. Yeah, so he was just not interested, and so it took a while to get him interested in it. And I did that through Gertie and through Don Allfeld and other people who knew him.
Yeah, and Gertie is his widow.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Yeah, seems like a really cool person. From the,
she's a very, very sweet lady. Yes.
Yeah. You get a really real respect for her and doing what she did for Jan in the last part of his life. Definitely was a good thing for him to have a person like that in his life. It was that loyal and loving. So how did you graduate to becoming the Jan and Dean historian? You know, as Mark Lewison was to the Beatles, that's what Mark A. Moore is for Jan and Dean. And Don McCrory was for the Beach Boys. You know, you're the authority. How did that happen? How did you get access to the archives?
Well, my interest led me to contact him. I was looking to, I wanted to talk to Jan, and I eventually did, but obviously it took me talking to his wife mostly.
Yeah.
Because I just told her what I wanted to do, and it just happened that Jan still had his archive, right?
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this is stuff that has been pilfered over the years, right? It's not complete.
Oh, yeah.
It's very sad and maddening, actually, that you get to a point, hey, what's missing here? This should still be here. That's not good.
And Jan being ransacked started, you know, immediately, within days of his accident.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah, so that's like, yeah, it's happened all the time. And so this is not only a case for his business documentation, his legal documentation. Most of it's there. A lot of it's gone. But his musical documentation, right? All of his original music scores, very, very important stuff.
Yeah.
Most of it's still there. Some of it's gone, and some of what's gone is very important. And so it's frustrating, right? So I guess a lot of people in Jan's situation would not have even what he has, right? But because he could read music and he was a music arranger, he kept all of his evidence, right, or documentation. He kept it very methodically filed, right? All very much meticulous. But the stuff had been pilfered so much over the years, some of it is gone, and that's very unfortunate.
Yeah.
But a lot of it still exists.
Yeah, definitely. And what is there is absolutely revelatory. It's just fascinating to look over the scores and the documentation that's there, and the wealth of documentation that are there really detailed in the day by day book, but obviously directly informs the narrative of Dead Man's Curve as well. Both of which are just great books, two of my favorite books on rock and roll, and on this character that I've been fascinated by for like 30 years. After going through this whole thing with Jan, about Jan Barry, how do you feel about him as a person, as an artist? Like, what did you learn? What do you feel you really learned? Yeah, like two or three points that, what do you really come away with?
Well, I come away with his ambition to start with, and just, kind of a do-it-yourself attitude, just kind of pushing ahead. And you're not the greatest vocalist on earth, right? But you want to produce records. But you do become a great producer. You become a great arranger, and you're a songwriter, and you collaborate with others. So it's just a determination to make it happen. And by way of his personality, just being a type A person with the extremely high intellect that he had, he was a leader, right? And his leadership qualities were recognized early on by his grade school and middle school and high school teachers, and we have all that online as a record, right? So
Yeah, there's some incredible documentation to be found at the official Jan and Dean website.
right, so you have that, and this guy's trying to be creative. He I think the rock and roll in a lot of ways took him by surprise because it was something he was interested in. He always planned to go to college. And so he found himself a high school student with a hit record. Then he found himself in college, and the music career is getting bigger. And then he's in medical school, and music career is at a peak. So it's all happening at the same time. And he's got this dual life that's bigger on the music side, but equally demanding on the medical school side, on the college side. So that's kind of unheard of. I still struggle to wrap my mind around it. I don't know. I mean, I get people who have high intellect, but he juggled it for a while successfully, and then it fell apart. But just the fact that he did, I think that's the main takeaway.
And after immersing yourself in the world of Jan's music, what do you come away with that in terms of what made Jan Barry Jan Barry?
Well,
In terms of being a musician.
I think his independence. He learned from so many people that he was able to eventually control the room. Of course, he was controlling the room early on, but he eventually came to control the room at the highest pinnacle of LA studio life, right? That's it. That's in United and Western with the Wrecking Crew. Doesn't get any better than that. And just trying to do his own thing, being influenced by others, and just trying to, maybe we can have a hit record. If we don't, we don't. But if we do, that's great. But I'm still in medical school, I mean, he was trying to cover all the bases.
And he was at a time when the studios of Hollywood, was kind of a veritable village of the giants. He was one of the giants.
Yes.
He walked tall, in the studios alongside Phil Spector and Brian Wilson and all the other people working worldwide, really, but particularly think of the West Coast and Los Angeles at the time.
Well, and that's another thing that I think is very important is that his colleagues really did admire him. They liked working with him. Bones Howe, these are very famous engineers. Bones Howe became an engineer, became a record producer. Lanky Lindstedt, these people had affection for Jan. They liked working with him. The stereotypical stuff about Jan's personality and being a bad guy and so forth, and all of it taken together. You take all of that, but these people, they liked working with him. They did not have a negative view of him. The string leader, Sid Sharp, loved him. He said most of the stuff, the negative stuff you hear about Jan is bull, he would say. But at the same time, you have to take all that. You take the positive, you take the negative, put it all together, and it presents a very well-rounded picture of an artist that has been pretty much neglected over the years.
These other people that we're talking about as Jan's artistic peers, many books have been written about Phil Spector and Brian Wilson and these other people, but this is the first real serious biography of Jan Barry, and you had the keys, man. You did it. Congratulations.
Well, thanks. It was a joy. It took forever. It took far longer than I've ever thought, but it would be the case. But unfortunately, I could never work full time on it. But at the same time, it was always a joy to have it in the background to fall back on and work on.
Yeah. And these books, The Dead Man's Curve, The Rock and Roll Life of Jan Barry, available from McFarland Press, very cool publisher. And I believe the Jan and Dean record is still in print.
Yes.
Yeah, you can get both of those from your fine booksellers and Amazon and all that type of stuff. And I believe, are there Kindle editions of both?
Yes.
Yeah. I've checked out. Yeah, for my own research, I have a online. I have a Kindle edition of Jan and Dean record. It looks beautiful, but both books are designed really, really well. I would recommend just investing in a copy of either one if you haven't already. They're incredible. And so, what's next for Mark Amore?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I've been working on this so long. I'm going to take a break and do my normal day job for a while, and then we'll see what happens.
Right on. Well, you know that wherever you get involved in the future creatively, you always have a place to come and talk about music on the Shades Radio Network. And thanks so much for involving us in the promotion of this book and doing this long interview and being a part of the celebration of the work and the life of Jan Barry.
Right on. Thanks so much.
And so, yeah, I guess we'll talk to you next time, Mark. Thank you so much. What we're about to do now is go into the rest of the Jan Barry story musically, going into the Batman era, and then into some tracks from Filet of Soul, and then we'll juxtapose Save for a Rainy Day, Dean's project without Jan, and then Carnival of Sound, which was Jan's project without Dean, and then into Jan's solo material from the 70s into the mid-80s, ending with the track Ocean Park Angel. Should be about another 3 hours of music. I hope anyone listening who's tuned in maybe for the first time to Shades Radio enjoys it. And thanks again, Mark.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, man.
Same here.
All right. I will talk to you soon, my friend.